The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio.
Hear ye,
hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session, pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is 2018-797, the State of Ohio versus Darren Taylor. For the appellant, Mr. French.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, good morning. I'd like to begin by reserving 4 minutes for a rebuttal. Thank you. In criminal cases, Revised Code 2947.23 requires trial courts to impose court costs against all convicted defendants regardless of their indigency. However, once imposed, subsection C of that statute permits the trial court to waive, suspend, or modify the payment of court costs either at the time of sentencing or at any time thereafter. So the question raised by this appeal is this: are there specific findings or considerations that a trial court must make or must undertake before denying a defendant's post-judgment motion to modify, suspend, or vacate court costs? Now, the statute itself provides no guidance. The statute does not impose any specific requirements, any specific findings, or considerations that a trial court must make before granting or denying such a motion. But this appeal arose because the Second District Court of Appeals saw things differently. The Second District Court of Appeals determined that before a trial court can deny a motion to vacate or suspend payment of court costs, the trial court must consider the defendant's indigency and ability to pay.
What else would a court take into consideration when ruling on a motion?
There are any number of considerations that a trial court could undertake. Certain financial resources.
How would they
other
know
sources
that?
Of income.
How would they know the financial resources of the defendant?
Well, the only way they would know that is if the defendant provided that information. And the state would submit that the burden for these types of motions should be on the defendant. This court
held. How is that different from determining the ability to pay, if you said like financial resources?
The ability to pay is certainly implicit in what a trial court should consider. However, there's a difference between what a court may or should consider and what a court must consider.
So you stated when you opened that the that there was no guidance given by the statute, correct?
The statute, right, gives no direction as to what a trial court is required to consider.
So why can't the courts decide that, like the Second District did, since the statute doesn't give us any guidance?
Well, because the Second District is imposing requirements on the trial court that simply do not exist in law. There is no statute, no rule, no regulation that requires a trial court to make any specific findings or determinations when ruling on this motion.
So they can just deny it out of hand without motion denied, period?
Well, it is purely within the discretion of the court whether to grant or deny this motion.
Okay, but discretion would suggest that you're basing that on some information. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes.
Okay. How are you going to get that information, and what should that information be?
You would get that information from the defendant who's making this application.
Okay, so the defendant makes an application, says, I'm moving the court to modify the imposition of court costs based on financial inability to pay. here's my income for the next 20 years while I'm in prison.
And the court would consider that information, and it may, but is not required, to waive the imposition of court costs regardless of indigency. That is essentially what this court has said in State v. White.
Counselor, we know this case isn't about whether it gets waived. It's about what the court has to consider. Well, for me at least, it's about what the court has to consider when ruling on the motion and what is and what needs to happen for there to be meaningful appellate review. As the Chief said, can the trial court just say, motion denied? Would that be an abuse of discretion?
If the court simply said in a one-sentence order, motion denied, then it would be reviewed for an abuse of discretion, and the appellate court would look at the record as a whole, whatever that record may be, to determine whether or not, based upon the record, based upon the totality of the circumstances and the totality of the information available to the trial court at the time it considered the motion, whether or not it was an abuse of discretion, whether or not the trial court's decision was unreasonable, arbitrary, or unconscionable. It is purely a discretionary decision by the trial court whether or not to grant or deny the motion.
Counsel, yes. What evidence in this case did the trial court have that was contrary to the defendant's motion saying that he would not have the ability to pay? He was going to be in prison till he was 80 years old.
The information that the trial court had, and it must also be an important consideration that the trial court deciding this motion was the sentencing court at the time of trial. So arguably the trial court in considering this motion had knowledge from the original pre-sentence investigation, knowledge about the defendant's background above and beyond simply what was in the motion. What the defendant, what Taylor said in this case.
Counsel, did he rely on that?
There's no indication specifically of what the trial court relied on.
Which goes back to Justice Stewart's question. How is an appellate court going to review what the judge did?
Well, again, it's a discretionary decision. It's within the trial court's discretion. And if the record as a whole, when reviewed by the appellate court, goes counter to the discretion exercised by the trial court in denying the motion, then it would be reasonable for the appellate court to find that it was an abuse of discretion.
How do we know what the trial court reviewed with a simple denial?
Well, we don't. We don't necessarily.
So trial courts could get the motion, say deny, punt, let it go to the Court of Appeals, then require the Court of Appeals to go through the record to see if there's any basis for the denial.
That would be one interpretation of it, yes.
Can you hear appellate court judges across the state of Ohio pulling their hair out?
Well, yes, but in cases where decisions by the trial court are purely discretionary, it is oftentimes difficult for appellate courts to find a basis for determining whether the trial court did or did not abuse its discretion. Sometimes it's a hurdle that cannot be overcome. Look at simple sentencing statutes where there's a range available to a trial court. If a trial court, without explanation, simply says, I'm going to impose a 6-year prison sentence, and the defendant argues that was an abuse of discretion because the trial court should have given me 4 years. Well, there's not necessarily anything in the record to say that 6 versus 4 is an abuse of discretion, but sometimes that's simply a hurdle that, under the circumstances, may not be able to be overcome.
And let me get back to, in your brief, you said the Second District Court of Appeals abuses erred because it disregarded the plain language of 2947. What did it disregard? What language in the statute did it disregard?
It disregarded, perhaps it's not simply a matter of disregarding the statute. It's a matter of reading into the statute requirements or obligations that simply aren't there.
But hasn't this court and other appellate courts manufactured or imposed certain analyses when the statute is devoid of such an analysis? What should be considered? If the legislature doesn't set forth what should be considered, why can't the courts do it?
Because courts cannot read words or requirements into a statute that are not there. The legislature...
Didn't we do that in Bunnell? State versus Bunnell, we required certain findings for consecutive sentences based on the statute and that they be put into the judgment entry. That's not in the statute.
Well, there does exist a statute that requires certain findings that a trial court must make before imposing consecutive sentences.
On the record and in the judgment entry. Bunnell added that to the statute, if you will.
And the statute does now exist to statutorily mandate those findings, yes. But perhaps the distinction is that in Bunnell, that is a criminal punishment. That is a sentencing statute for which there are certain constitutional burdens that a trial court must also overcome when imposing a criminal sanction. Court costs are not a criminal sanction. Court costs are a civil obligation and a civil obligation only.
But the trial court implied it was punishment based on his criminal conduct. He put himself where he is. He made the decision to do what he did that caused these fines or these fees to be imposed upon him.
Well, I suppose you could say that in any case, whether it's a criminal case or a civil case.
So based on that language alone, could the Court of Appeals have reversed for an abuse of discretion? Because it seems like you're not necessarily arguing with that aspect of it, although you might. You're saying the fact that the court required a certain analysis is improper.
Well, yes. As to that particular sentence or paragraph of the trial court's decision, even the Second District didn't necessarily say that that was an abuse of discretion or that necessarily was indicative of the trial court having an ulterior motive or trying to use this motion or these court costs as a criminal sanction. It is also important to note that the very next sentence of the trial court's decision said, moreover, there is no evidence that the defendant is unable to make any payment towards the cost at this time or that he will not be able to make payments towards the fees once his term of incarceration ends.
Doesn't that belie the record?
No, I don't believe it does. What Taylor indicated is that he is employed within the institution. He makes currently $19 a month. The only obligation as far as expenses that he notes definitively is, I think he indicated, $1 a month is deducted for electricity. He mentions that the other money he likes to use for hygiene and stamps and things like that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Let me ask you one more question. I know I've asked you a lot of questions.
No, that's fine.
Your time is fading. If the trial court had granted, let's say Mr. Taylor in this instance was 30 years old, was sentenced on a crime and convicted and had 11 years, let's say an F1, served 11 years, had these costs assessed, has a trust fund, moved for motion to waive costs, and the trial court grants it. Wouldn't you want to appeal based on present or future ability to pay, 30 years old, will be out in 11 years, has a trust fund, but the court still granted a motion to waive payment of costs?
Well, perhaps that, and I don't want to dodge the question, but perhaps that is a different issue altogether, because there is a separate statute that provides that if a defendant is not indigent, the trial court may not waive court costs.
Fair enough. Thank you.
So there would be a specific statute that arguably the trial court would be violating in that instance. But when a defendant is indigent, this court stated in White that the court may, but is not required to waive court costs due solely to indigency. So the fact that the defendant is indigent is not in and of itself a determining factor as to whether or not a trial court is obligated to waive court costs. It's also important to keep in mind that there are many ways that court costs can be collected. There is, as this court has found, because these are civil obligations, the civil collection procedures, garnishments of wages, of funds, attachments of property, of other assets, are available mechanisms for collecting court costs. That's what sort of gets us into the next, what the state would argue is the next error committed by the trial court, or excuse me, the second district, is that it obligated trial courts to, in essence, do a financial audit of the defendant's assets to determine whether or not there are any exemptions to the garnishment or attachment statute that's set out in Revised Code 23-2966 or certain administrative code provisions. But that is not, nor should it be, the obligation of the trial court or the trial court to undergo those types of evaluations. The administrative code specifically places that obligation, if there are exemptions, places the obligation on the defendant to raise those obligations with the Department of Corrections, so that the Department of Corrections then can exclude certain assets that the defendant may have, or that the Department of Corrections or the clerk's office would attempt to utilize to collect or execute on that judgment. And a third option, of course, is community service, which is statutorily provided for, that in lieu of court costs, of paying court costs, a defendant can be ordered to perform community service as a mechanism by which to pay off costs. And in fact, Taylor, in his motion for reconsideration, indicates in his motion specifically that he does participate in a community service program at the institution. That is another option that a trial court could use to satisfy the defendant's obligation to pay court costs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've used your time. Counsel.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Requiring an analysis of present and future ability to pay does not ask this court to add words to Section 2947.23. It requires only that this court give effect to the words, to the verbs chosen by the General Assembly. Doing so also comports with the purpose of imposing court costs in the first instance, and it avoids any constitutional questions that might create second-generation litigation in this issue.
Do we have to overrule State v. White?
You do not.
Well, so if White says that a court can impose court costs on someone who's indigent, then why would a court need to make findings about whether or not they're indigent?
This is not about imposition. This is about what to do after the imposition. And White explicitly left it. I'm sorry.
Presumably, if the court can impose them, then it's not required to waive them, then, is it? I mean, the analysis in White is that the statute says that they're mandatory, so the court can impose them regardless of whether or not someone is indigent. So why would findings be required about whether or not they're indigent?
This is not simply about indigency. This is about current and future ability to pay. White dealt with a single snapshot in time, indigency at the time of imposition. White expressly left open the question of how costs are collected, and this case answers that question.
Well, aren't the way costs are collected, aren't they dealt with by some of the provisions about collection? I mean, hasn't that been explicitly dealt with?
Yes. And then the General Assembly acted in 2013 to create sub C of the statute, which did not exist at the time of White. And sub C was enacted in part to remediate the impact of court costs that followed White and Clevenger. So White expressly left open the question of when costs may be waived. The General Assembly created a statute saying costs may be waived, suspended, or modified at the time of sentence or any time thereafter to help answer the question of how court costs should be waived upon the request of a defendant. And the verbs chosen by the General Assembly in writing that statute tell us a lot about what trial courts should consider when deciding a court cost motion.
Counsel, the proposition before us says that a trial court need not consider the present or future ability to pay because it's not in the statute. You concede it's not in the statute, correct?
I do not.
You don't?
No. The express words present and future ability to pay are not in the statute, but using that phrase is not the only way that the General Assembly can tell a court to do that analysis. And the verbs chosen here, a court has four options. It can do nothing, it can waive costs, it can modify costs, or it can suspend them. And it's difficult, if not impossible, for a trial court to reasonably decide between those four options it's given by the statute without some consideration of ability to pay.
Well, how do you reconcile the General Assembly's lack of specific factors to consider being explicit in the statute when the law was, when this certain provision was amended based on the statute as existed at the time? How do you reconcile the General Assembly not putting in, like we were talking about in Bunnell, although I know this is civil, what should be considered?
Had the General Assembly simply wished for the court to have completely unbridled discretion, it would have said, you may modify court costs. And modify could be to waive, it could be to suspend, it could be to do anything to the costs. The General Assembly gave the court three different options, waive, suspend, or modify. And for those options to be meaningful options, for there to be a distinction between them, there has to be some analysis of present and future ability to pay.
But what if there is an analysis, but just simply not listed, not specifically set forth on the record?
If it's considered, this is actually a very good example, this case. In this case, the trial judge did write a judgment entry that made findings about Mr. Taylor's ability to pay. The Second District reviewed the record in this case and said that was an unreasonable determination based upon Mr. Taylor's motion and based upon all of his individualized circumstances. Similarly, if a trial court were to deny a cost motion and an appellate court is asked to review that on an abuse of discretion standard, the appellate court can look to the record and see, does the record support a denial? Does the record demonstrate that there's a reasonable jurist who could find no present or future. There is a present and future ability to
pay. But didn't the second district go beyond that?
By requiring the exemption statute to be considered? The second district's jurisprudence about the exemption statute is somewhat a little bit confusing, because in Copeland, the second district suggested that the exemption statute might be a way to consider present and future ability to pay. In Dunson, the second district said it should be considered, and in Taylor, they're saying it should be considered. The consideration of present and future ability to pay needs to be reasonable. It needs to be based on the individualized circumstances of the person who's making the motion. Using the exemption statute is a best practice way to do that. I would concede that the statute does not require it.
Counsel, if the trial court had found that all court costs are waived and just entered an entry, all court costs waived, would they have to make some findings about the ability? Would you even be here?
I would not be here, no.
even if they didn't make any findings, correct?
That's correct.
So they don't really need to make any findings.
Well, the proposition of law, I think that this court in State versus Robert Taylor just a couple of weeks or months ago dealt with the difference between findings and determination, or findings and consideration. And the proposition of law here is that the trial court needs to consider present and future ability to pay. Again, it might be best practice to make explicit findings, but the statute doesn't require explicit findings. And the Second District didn't fault the trial court for its failure to make explicit findings. It faulted the trial court because the analysis employed by the trial court was not supported by the record.
In other words, they found the court abused its discretion.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I want to go back a little bit on present ability to pay. Okay. In your brief, I believe you mentioned the OAC and the $25 requirement, right?
Yes.
Do we have a ripe controversy here for present ability, at least? The person's never had $25, so there's nothing to dispute, is there?
We do have a ripe controversy because the interest is accruing on this debt. It's getting larger. When costs continue.
But he's not being garnished, right?
It's not being garnished at this time.
It's not being attached.
Not at this time.
No. So what's the controversy for present ability?
There may not be a controversy for present ability. As to future ability, there certainly is a controversy. Mr. Taylor will be in prison until he's at least in his mid-80s. As people in his circumstance remain in prison and have a cost bill that is accreting interest, it makes future ability to pay more difficult. It creates, for people who don't have life sentences, significant barriers to reentry. So there's a ripe controversy on future ability to pay. As to the OAC, the state's argument that there's an administrative process that can do the work Mr. Taylor is asking the trial court to do fails for a couple reasons. First, the OAC provision creates a general rule that $25 must remain on someone's books before any additional money is garnished. But that general rule does not deal with circumstances on the margins. And there's circumstances where $25 in a commissary account may not be enough for certain prisoners. Mr. Braden, whose case this court considered, couldn't afford shoes. Prisoners have obligations to buy not just commissary items like food. They buy clothing. They buy laundry detergent. They buy a whole host of other things that are required for daily living. They have medical copays as well. If somebody has special needs, such as is true, especially for people serving life sentences who may one day die in prison, have more significant medical needs and might need certain sanitary devices because they become incontinent, those cost money. And the OAC provision, while it might be a general rule that is protective of the vast majority of people, certainly says nothing for people who are in marginal circumstances. And that is one of the reasons why 2947.23 exists. There's no administrative exhaustion requirement. It asks the court to consider an individualized determination of ability to pay. I want to go shift topics a little bit to the question of reviewability, because that came up earlier. This court in State versus Threat promised defendants an abuse of discretion review when costs are not waived or modified at the time of sentencing. The state's proposition of law in this case renders that abuse of discretion promise completely illusory. And I think that this case shows why. Under the state's proposition, there's no limitation on the court's rationale for denying a motion to waive, modify, or suspend costs. That rationale could be punitive, as it was here. If a trial court uses a punitive rationale that speaks of choices and consequences, but they have wide discretion to decide not to waive or modify for any reason, that rationale will stand.
Counselor, would we have to affirm the Court of Appeals in how far they went with their analysis? Couldn't a Court of Appeals look at a trial court's denial, and if there's nothing there, saying we think the court abuses discretion because there's nothing that equates a Court of Appeals decision with what's in the record? Couldn't it just simply be a reversal for abuse of discretion as opposed to imposing certain requirements?
This court could resolve Mr. Taylor's case in that manner and remand because the trial court abuses discretion. The cost suspension provision requires, however, in its plain language, some analysis of present and future ability to pay. It might not require the specific analysis that the Second District required of a review of the exemption provision, but for a trial court to meaningfully decide between waiving, modifying, or suspending court costs, it must consider in some capacity present and future ability to pay. I would have no quarrel with this court reversing on the grounds that the trial court unreasonably considered present and future ability to pay and remanding for some reasonable consideration that doesn't necessarily involve a forensic accounting.
But that's not before us, right? What's before us is specifically whether the trial court need to consider present and future ability to pay.
I think it is before you because of the scope of the state's proposition of law. The state says both that trial courts do not need to consider present and future ability to pay, and then says that the trial court does not need to consider the exemption statute. Our position is that the trial court does need to consider present and future ability to pay. However, we are not defending the requirement that the exemption statute must be reviewed in every case. Finally, I just want to go back to the purpose of court costs because that animates this entire debate. Court costs are not imposed as punishment under the law. As we see in this case, sometimes court costs are not waived out of a punitive rationale. But the purpose of imposing them in the first instance is to reimburse taxpayers. Taxpayers cannot be reimbursed by somebody who lacks the current and future ability to pay. So to not consider a defendant's present and future ability to pay when they've pled that they have none divorces the analysis of the waiver motion from the purpose of court costs in the first instance. Holding that trial courts must consider present and future ability to pay is completely consistent with this court's line of cases starting with Stratman versus Strutt in 1969 that say costs are civil. Allowing a trial court not to consider ability to pay runs a significant risk that these costs will be treated punitively and that the line between civil and punitive will blur. I ask this court to affirm the Second District in the way I requested. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. French, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
This court made it clear in State v. White that the waiver of court costs is permitted but not required if a defendant is indigent. There is no provision that would require a trial court under any particular circumstances to waive court costs.
Counsel, could a trial court simply call the clerk and say, you know, I'm issuing a standing order. Any motion that comes in that asks for a waiver here, I want it denied. Would that be an abuse of discretion? I don't even want to read them, just deny them.
I would say yes, that would be an abuse of discretion, so because the trial court's not even giving any individualized consideration to the motion. Then yes, if there was a standing order, I believe this court, the name of the case escapes me, but there was a trial court that had a standing order, all motions for intervention in lieu of conviction were overruled. And this court found that was an abuse of discretion because the trial court, at a minimum, must give some level of individualized consideration to the motion. So yes, using your example, that would be clearly an abuse of discretion. But that is not what we have here. What we have here is a court of appeals saying that unless a trial court makes these specific findings, that in and of itself is an abuse of discretion.
Well, counsel, what it says on the remanded for consideration of Taylor's indigency, well, according to White, indigency alone is not going to negate, and his present and future ability to pay court costs. Taylor presents information about his current and future ability to pay, which is his burden, correct?
Correct.
The court takes a look at that and said, I'm not convinced. I'm not going to waive. Why is that a problem? It just says considerations. It doesn't say findings. It doesn't say determination.
Yes, you're correct.
Because what the court did take into consideration was you're a convicted felon. You brought this on yourself, so live with it, right?
And that there's no evidence to suggest he does not have the ability to pay any of these costs.
Okay, but he's not being garnished, and he won't be garnished.
On this record, there's no...
Okay, he gets $19 a month. If somehow he gets up to $25 a month, there might be a garnishment. Who knows what that might be?
Correct.
Could be 50 cents, could be a dollar.
Correct.
Who knows? But at this point, that's not impacting him, correct?
Correct.
All right. So I really fail to see what is so demanding and what is out of line with the statute when the trial court is ordered to consider his indigency and his present and future ability to pay court costs, which is taken directly from the statute. And granted, it says before imposing financial sanction, blah, 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 the court shall consider offender's present and future ability to pay. That's before imposing. However, the argument would be that is the consideration under these circumstances as well.
Court costs must be imposed in all cases,
right,
regardless of the present or future ability to pay.
Great. Yes.
Present and future ability to pay court costs are never a required finding by a trial court. There are other statutes involving financial sanctions, fines, restitution, where the statute specifically provides that a court, before imposing mm-hmm. such financial sanctions, must consider the defendant's present or future ability to pay.
Costs are not... They're imposed. I understand that. I think we all understand that. I guess, you know, the question here is, what does the court have to find or determine or consider upon a request to waive those costs?
The trial court can consider any matters, any evidence, any factors it wishes to consider, and there are no requirements. Which is why the Court of Appeals...
How does that make for an equal application of the law? One judge looks at the fact that you're a convicted felon and you brought this on yourself, and, you know, I think that you can pay these costs.
If that were the only finding that the trial court made in this case... suggesting that I'm denying this simply because I wish to punish you, or I wish to consider this as a punishment, then I would submit that that would be an abuse of discretion, because that would be unreasonable.
Okay, but would you agree that that portion of the judge's, the trial court's rationale is punitive?
I would not agree with that. And I don't believe that even the Second District, in its opinion, characterized that as punitive. It recognized that that is a statement that would apply in virtually any case under any circumstances. And
does it have relevance?
I don't know that it has any relevance, no.
I can't see what the relevance is that you're a convicted felon. I mean, they all are, so.
Right, I would agree. There's no relevance necessarily to that portion of the trial court's decision, and it really weighs neither for or against in isolation on the abuse of discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.